This is Barry Tyker of the UW Oral History Project. It is the last day of February, 1990. I'm at the home of Mrs. Gertrude Wilson again, and we're going to begin today's interview by talking about the five or six people who we have not discussed thus far, the list that we began about 2 weeks ago or so. Van Valzen.
Van Valzen, V-A-L-Z-A-H. Dr. Robert Van Valza was called here to the medical school from the University of Pennsylvania by his colleague, Dr. Joseph S. Evans, who preceded him coming here. Dr. Van Valza and Dr. Middleton came together following Dr. Joseph Sprague Evans. Dr. Van Valza was a Southerner from Virginia. He and his wife built a lovely house on Chadbourne Avenue. It's still there between Roby Road and Allen Street, on the north side of the street with a white picket fence in front. Lovely red brick colonial house. Dr. Van Valza was greatly loved. His wife was never happy here. Never really, it seemed to the rest of us, to try to acclimate herself to the north. She also was a Southerner.
Did she end up spending?
Turn it off. Get in.
When Dr. Van Valza built his house over on Chadbourne, was that pretty much a wooded area, or was there pretty much development there?
No, it wasn't wooded then. not at that. You see, that must have been about 19... around 1914-15, and it wasn't wooded then. The woods had been cut down.
Let's talk a little bit about the what it was like around here before the houses were built. You showed me a picture, and it was pretty much past out that way, out west. It seemed like a field.
Well, it was open fields, and I had lots of pictures. I'll show you later, some other time when you want.
What about around here? Was this woods around the Allen Street, Van Hise, Chadbourne, Chamberlain area?
No, it had all been cut over, you see, for the Civil War to use the wood.
Oh, so that's where the
trees went.
Uh-huh.
So what is now is a second crop.
Oh, okay.
That's not the original.
So this was originally
wood. Originally, it had a lot of trees.
And then it was
but
cut
Camp
down.
Randall, you see, and the Civil War needed wood.
So Camp Randall cut it for the fuel.
It was used.
Okay.
I don't know what you use wood for in a camp, but you do in those days.
Yeah. Well, heat, food, I guess, just about everything.
Yes.
We have E.B. Van Vleck.
Oh, Hasbrook and I. E.B. Van Vleck is the senior Van Vleck.
Mm-hmm.
For whom Van Vleck Hall is named. Professor E.B. Van Vleck was professor of mathematics, very, very fine person. He had an only son, Hasbrook, who was my friend since we were both children. And the last time that, and Hasbrook, who died probably 10 years ago. But I told you before that when his mother would telephone my mother and say, we will come and get Gertrude if she will come and have Sunday dinner with us and play train with Hasbrook. Mm. They had a beautiful house on North Pinckney Street, right on the lake, on Lake Mendota.
Mm-hmm.
Great deal of money. The son, Hasbrook, inherited his father's Japanese print collection, and at Hasbrook's death, it went to the Elgin. The last time I saw him, I said, "Hasbrook, if you leave those prints to Harvard, I'll never forgive you."
Spell Hasbrook for our person doing this tape, will you?
H-A-S-B-R-O-U-C-H.
Never heard that as a first name.
Well, they were Dutch. A family. And a great deal of money. And he was an only child.
Did they have the money? They had the money. They came here with the money.
Oh, yes. And when Professor Van Vleck, I'm talking about the senior, died, Hasbrook inherited his money. And also he had two sisters, maiden ladies, and he got theirs too. Great deal of money.
Elsom.
Dr. Elsom, Bernardo Elsom, was, I don't know what title he had, but he was the one who presided over the swimming pool at the building where your office is. I had something in the athletics, I'm sure. And he was in charge of whoever was allowed to swim there. And as a child, I swam there every summer for $3.
For the whole summer?
Yes, whole summer.
I think he was somehow connected with the physical education.
Yes,
department.
I think he was.
And he was on the athletic committee.
Yes, I think he was a very important person in the physical education department.
Was he an MD?
He was called Dr. Elsom, but I don't know whether he was or not. Remember, I've told you before, some people were doctors
right.
And some were professors.
Well,
but
about,
he may have been an MD.
The thing about Elsom is he's called doctor in all the literature, and he's the only person I know of involved in the athletic doings who was a doctor.
He may have been.
And I was wondering how he got involved with the athletic aspect.
I don't know, but he did.
A doctor, huh?
Yes, Dr. Elsom, E-L-S-O-M.
Someone I'll have to keep tracking down. We have Westerman.
All I can tell you is that he was professor of history here and left and went to, I think, Columbia. But he was in history and very well thought of.
Now, most.
This was a long time ago.
Okay. Carl Jung is next.
Carl Jung was in English. And he left also, but he was very well thought of and left and went to, I believe, Yale.
You're talking about a lot of people leaving here. And
we lost a lot of good people.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. They all seemed to go back east. Was that
yes.
a common thing?
Yes. I don't know any who went west.
Yeah. I guess there wasn't.
Well, of course, Leland Stanford was a private and very good university, but it was pretty far away.
Took a pioneer spirit to get there, I imagine.
They were called either to Yale or Columbia or Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know anyone who went to Princeton.
Was it considered prestigious to be called by those schools and go?
No, I think it was considered more of a great loss to us.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't dwell on the prestige of being called.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did many people refuse, turn down jobs that you know?
I don't know of anyone who turned down one.
Okay, we have a...
They probably offered them a lot more money.
Yeah. Still going on today.
Yes, private institutions would pay more than a state university.
Has pay been an issue over time with the university?
Well, they certainly weren't paid much when my father was here, but of course prices weren't what they are now either, but they weren't paid much. But still the spirit was a wonderful spirit. Money wasn't talked about so much. If you were a professor, you expected to be poor.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't expect to go into business. You expected not to have much money.
So that sort of came with the territory?
Yes, it came with the job.
That's interesting. We have one name on the list, and then I added another one. The last name on the list is Zdarowicz.
Oh, Stanowicz.
Stanowicz.
Zdan.
Zdan, sorry.
Yes, well, you can't read
that. Is that Casimir?
Casimir Stanowitz, yes.
I know.
And he, well, Frederica, his wife, lives at Methodist Retirement Center. Turn that off or I'll tell you.
Anything else about Professor
Stanowitz? He built a beautiful house up here on, right up here in the area where Standish Henning lives. Professor Standish, the current man in the English department, Standish Henning, who goes to Grace Church and is Shakespeare enthusiast. Beautiful house up here. But Casimir was a lovely, lovely person. Now I'll tell you some real gossip. So turn that thing off. This isn't, has nothing.
Well, you'll just have to miss out on all that, people. I'm not talking. The name I added is someone we mentioned, we talked about a little before when we started our session today, and that's Max Mason.
I can't tell you a great deal about Max Mason, other than that he and Ellery Leonard were great enemies. And also, Max Mason was not particularly popular among, a lot of people did not like Max Mason. They felt he was pushing himself, that he wanted to be president, and that he was pushing himself. And when, I want to get this straight now, a very prominent member in the German department saw him walk down the aisle at Grace Church one day. He said in a loud whisper, "Schweinhund." Hmm. Max Mason was not well liked.
Huh. What was the basis of Leonard and Mason's rivalry?
I think it was, it wasn't rivalry. It had to do with Leonard's wife, first wife's family.
Hmm. So it was a personal type.
Yes, it was a personal feud.
Now, Max Mason was mentioned as a candidate, I believe, for president.
I think he was.
Glenn Frank.
I think so.
Glenn Frank. As a matter of fact, as I understand it, he left the university partly because he did not get that presidency.
Probably. I think that people were relieved that he wasn't made president.
Do you think that...
I think that people welcomed Glenn Frank. But Glenn Frank never fitted in.
Yeah.
But that wasn't anybody's fault, except the people who called him.
Yeah. So
we said that the other day.
Yeah, that's
that people don't become a different person.
That's a very interesting point. And so the faculty must have been relieved to know that Mason was going, because he probably wouldn't have been a different person if he'd have been president either.
Yeah, Max Mason was not loved. He was able. People recognized that, but he certainly wasn't a favorite.
What was his department again?
I can't tell you.
We're going to leave the list now. I think we've gone
through
it.
Want to tell you something.
We're going to talk now a little bit about the Friday lunch group. And Mrs. Wilson has prepared a list of the, is this the initial members?
This is everybody who has been in it that I could remember.
Do you want me to just read it? Well, like this one here? Let's start out with Briggs.
Hazel Briggs.
Rice.
Well, I'll tell you first. In 1932, when I returned to Madison, I had been gone 13 years. I wondered what changes I would find. I expected a lot. But fortunately, there were enough of my old friends left. And we decided, a group of us, that we would form a club, which we would call the Friday Lunch Club. The original members, of which I am now the only surviving original member, consisted of myself, Hazel Briggs, who is now Hazel Rice, Rhoda Otto, Jane Goss, Elizabeth Rauschenbusch, Isabella Follett, and Dorothy Walton. Now, alphabetically, we'll talk about those.
Great.
We met every Friday. Of course, I couldn't go to all of the meetings because I was teaching. I was working. But, except in the summer. We met at noon and had our lunch at the Union. Not the cafeteria, the Beef Eater's room. Then we went to the house of the person who was hostess for that afternoon and played bridge, auction bridge at that time. At 4 o'clock, we had coffee and cake, and then went home.
You listed the original members. How is this club, if at all, related to the university?
Only in that most of them, practically all of them, were wives, either of important people in state government or university circles.
But that wasn't necessarily a
criteria. Oh, it wasn't a prerequisite, no, it just happened.
Okay.
You didn't have to pass an examination.
What was the, you just got in if you were asked, was that it?
Yes. You joined by invitation.
By invitation. Was it when there was an opening, when someone quit, or did you just decide occasionally?
Well, originally, we just decided that we would form this.
Okay. So let's start at the beginning of the alphabet. We have Briggs.
Hazel Briggs, first husband, Alfred Briggs, was very prominent as head of the state welfare system at that time. She came to Madison in 1934, years after we started the club. Alfred Briggs died in 1936, and she married after being a widow for some years. She married Professor William Gorham Rice.
From the law school.
Yes. So she is now Hazel Rice, and she and I are the oldest in the club, of course. She has just had her 94th birthday. She has her wits, she has physical problems, but at least she has her eyesight.
Caldwell.
Josephine Caldwell ran a renting library on State Street, and it was called the Hawthorne Bookshop, and it was very successful. She died a long, long time ago.
Now tell me a little bit about a renting library. How did that differ?
You go in and get current books and pay a certain amount a day. And
were there public libraries at the time?
Oh, yes.
So this was it.
But the public libraries didn't have the latest books then. It was really a very successful venture.
On State Street?
Yes. The first block from the square. On the State Street goes sort of at a diagonal east and west. The first block on the south side.
And when would this have been about?
Probably about in the 40s, 50s.
Curran.
Curvin.
Curvin. Sorry.
Helen Curvin. Helen Curvin, the wife of Professor Jonathan Curvin, retired. Madison Theater.
Dykstra.
Well, Lillian Dykstra, of course, was the wife of President Dykstra, and very friendly and pleasant person. She wasn't with us many years because the Dykstra regime here was not long, but she was very pleasant. She was the complete opposite of Mary Frank. She did not like, she never liked the chancellor's house. She said it was absolutely unfit for entertaining.
Mm-hmm. Who said that? Lillian?
Lillian Dykstra.
Why was it unfit?
She said it wasn't arranged right. You know there's an enormous reception hall there.
Yeah, I've been there. It
great deal
strange.
Of waste space. And she didn't like it because there was a great deal of entertaining, and she said it was very difficult. It wasn't arranged right.
Was she an active member of the Friday Club?
Not very.
Did you ever go over to the president's house?
Oh, yes. We went there. And she wasn't very active, but she was very friendly and pleasant.
When her husband, President Dykstra, was off in Washington serving on the Social Selective Service Commission, mm-hmm. Labor Mediation Board, and those kinds of things, did his wife generally stay at home during that, or was?
I think she stayed at home, yes.
Ely.
Oh, Richard T. Ely, Anna Ely, who later became Anna Morehouse. Well, Anna and I were childhood friends. The Elys lived just up the hill from us in the same block. The house, of course, is now lived in and owned by Dr. Barash. Richard T. Ely, we've talked about before.
Yes,
Anna was a very nice girl. We all liked Anna. I liked her very much as a child. And as a grown person, she was thwarted. Anna was fat. She didn't like it. And she could not accept the fact that she was overweight. She married Edward Morehouse, and Anna had a very tragic life. After her marriage, she developed cancer, which, and also had emotional problems.
Foster.
Jimmy Foster is a recent addition to our club, probably about 2 years ago. She's the wife of Professor William Foster in the law school. He has either completely or partially retired. And she's a very pleasant person, very nice.
So the club is still inviting new members in?
Well, we did. We were down to having less than four for bridge, which you can't do.
Yeah, I guess you need...
You need four.
You need four. Yeah, we'll talk computers
there. She's very recent.
We may have mentioned this before, but before I go on to the next name, I've interviewed several professors who were members of dining clubs.
Yes.
Things like that. Did you have any association with any types of other kinds of clubs like that?
With dining clubs are a modern institution at the university. The important clubs in the university were the Town and Gown Club, which was a combination of important townspeople and important university people. But dining clubs, as they are now called, were not in existence.
Goss.
John Goss. Whose wife, Jane, was there. Thing that everybody remembers about them is that they kept five Siamese cats. And Siamese cats are not friendly at all. And we were not awfully happy when we met at Jane Goss's house. They lived on Vilas Avenue in that circle over there. And Jane had considerable money in her own name because her money came from a distilled or water called from Poland Springs in Maine. They left, you know, went to Harvard. Mm-hmm. He was in political science.
Griswold.
Mabel Griswold, I can tell you nothing about except that she was with us off and on, and the reason she was invited to come was that she was Phil La Follette's secretary.
Mm. So she really wasn't an active member of the club for
him. No.
Here, Haygood.
Kathleen Haygood is our most recent addition within this last year. She's Hazel Rice's niece. Mm. And her husband, deceased now, was editor of the magazine that the State Historical Society puts out, Bill Haygood. Mm. She's a very pleasant person, lives over here on Grant Street.
A name familiar to all of us who live in Wisconsin, La Follette.
Isabel La Follette. I was always very fond of Isen La Follette. She had a hard life. She was married to Phil, and she had children, Bob and Judy and Sherry, and life was not easy for her.
Was Phil a pretty difficult man?
I think he was, yes. I think he was a very difficult person, and she had a difficult life. She was Isabel Bacon, and I don't know whether you've heard of the book publishing firm Align and Bacon in Boston. Mm-hmm. Well, she was a Bacon, but her father was not a member of that firm. She was born in Salt Lake City. How she met Phil, I don't know.
I was going to say, how did she end up
in Madison? I don't know. But anyway.
Did she finish her life here in Madison?
Yes, yeah, she died a number of years ago, but both. I shouldn't say that. La Follette.
It's on.
Lot in the cemetery. It's a beautiful lot. And they're all of the Follettes are buried there. Eisen and I used to go out there together. She wanted me to go with her on Memorial Day, always. Mm.
So that would be an annual trek to the...
Yes.
McCamey.
Jim McCamey came here, I think called by John Goss, in political science. His wife, Julia, had studied and got an MA degree in anthropology, University of Chicago. And Julia joined us a good many years ago. She no longer comes to Friday lunch. She's not well at all.
The last name on the list is McKendrick.
No, it's just on the... There's another side.
Oh, there's another side. Okay, the last name on side. What is McKendrick?
Dottie McKendrick, Paul McKendrick's wife. Very much a member of Friday Lunch Group. Her husband, Paul, is a retired professor of classics. And they're just back from... let's see, where'd they go? Oh, 2.5 months away. I never saw family travel as much in all my life as they do. They were 2.5 months in Florida and Mexico and have just recently returned and are now, in a couple of weeks, going to Arizona for this, what do they call it, spring training?
Oh, yeah.
Baseball stuff. and then they go off again somewhere else. Dottie's very, very fond of bridge, and she's a gourmet cook. Mm. Puts all the rest of us to shame because we don't take either the time nor have the interest.
I should point out on the tape that Mrs. Wilson hosted the Friday afternoon club last Friday. And you had five members?
We had five members, and I got the dessert from the Union Delicatessen. Incidentally, they put out very nice things. They made a black bottom pie.
Oh, yeah, that's their trademark.
It was wonderful.
I think Carson Gully developed that a long time ago.
And my daughter Jill got three little flags and three little hatchets and put them on top of the pie.
What and were we, the hatchets?
Hatchets.
What were the hatchets?
George
for?
Washington was President's Week.
Of course, it's President's Week.
With Lincoln, and we had a very nice time.
Wonderful. So the club is still going strong.
Yes.
I've turned the... Okay, we're on side two, and we just started talking about Rhoda Otto.
Max Otto's wife, very strong-willed person, very strong person in the community, and as I've said before, anything that was unkind that Max Otto did was usually at her instigation. The Ottos were on the trail of Glenn Frank and bound to get rid of him, and were very important in university displeasure with Glenn Frank.
Now, you had said before that you thought maybe Mrs. Otto was somehow involved in that anti-Frank.
She was.
Is there any particular reason that you can think of, any connection with La Follette or anything like that, that would account for that?
No, if Rhoda didn't like someone, she was out to do that person in, to do what she could to destroy that person.
Now, as far as you know, was it Glenn Frank she disliked, or was it Mary Frank, or was it the whole kid?
It was the whole, it was both.
Both of them?
Both of them.
Okay. Did she ever give any reasons that you know?
No, she wouldn't give a reason. Another person whom Rhoda didn't like was Julia Begholt, B-O-E-G-H-O-L-T, Carl Begholt, mm-hmm. who came here from Experimental College, was in the Experimental College, came from Amherst, and was in the philosophy department, and very able. And I think that Rhoda felt that Carl might be a competitor to Max. Max never had those feelings.
Mm. Getting off the track, off the list here for a second, we've talked about Max Otto or Rhoda Otto, maybe more correctly, being anti-Frank. Were there any other, Celery, of course, did not appreciate Glenn Frank too much either. Were there any other people that you know who were actively either supporters or against Glenn Frank?
Oh, the LaFollette's wanted to get rid of him, too.
Yeah, right. Of
yes.
They were many. Was there any, as far as you know, on that level, was what were the political motivations behind that, if there were?
I don't think it was political. I think there was a difference in political philosophy, yes. Mm-hmm. But other than that, of course, you know Madison is strongly, the faculty used to be strongly Democratic. I don't know whether it is now or not. I don't know. But you see, this group that I was a member of were very politically oriented, mm-hmm. all but me.
Mm-hmm. And their politics were mainly Democratic?
Oh, yes, and progressive.
Well, probably the next name on the list bears that out, and that's Rausenbusch.
Oh, E.B.
Elizabeth.
E.B. we called her.
E.B.
Elizabeth Brandeis.
Mm-hmm.
I've got nothing but good to say of E.B. She married Paul Rauschenbusch, who also came here with that group. I think he came from Amherst. I'm not sure, but I think he did.
With what group? The Experimental College Group?
Yes. Yeah. But he was, Paul Rauschenbusch was either the grandson of some very prominent Baptist minister in, I think, New York State. But he, Elizabeth Rauschenbusch was a lovely, lovely person and very able. She taught part-time in the university for years, of course, in labor problems. And her hobby was trying to improve the condition of migrant labor. She and Paul spent their last days. They built a house on Vilas Avenue, the third house from Edgewood Avenue, coming down the hill there. The Ottos lived in the first, the Dresdens in the next, and later the Waltons, and then the Rauschenbusches.
We're going to have pretty much a phone directory of where people live by the time we're finished with this interview. You have a name penciled in here in between two people whom, I don't know, we might have already talked about her. Rice, is that?
Hazel Rice, okay. Yes. We've talked about her.
Sharp.
Dorothy Sharp was, well, Professor Sharp, her father-in-law, was a longtime member of, I think, in psychology here. That was a name I omitted. Dorothy Sharp was married to Malcolm Sharp. And Malcolm Sharp's great interest over the years, he's deceased now, of course, was the injustice that he felt was done in Boston to the execution of the those men who were executed after being in prison 7 years.
I mean, what time period are you talking?
This was 1919.
And the famous case?
Yes. Very famous.
Sacco Vanzetti?
Yes. Yeah. Sacco Vanzetti case. And Malcolm Sharp, his life work was to prove that those men should never have been executed.
Did he make a convincing case?
No, he didn't. But it was.
Did he believe it?
He believed it himself. Right. He felt that they were absolutely innocent. But it was a dreadful thing. Those men were kept in prison for 7 years. And that's what I hold against President Lowell of Harvard. Because the three men who finally decided their fate were appointed by Governor Fuller. And Lowell was one of the three.
While we're on that subject of crime, there's one thing that happened during, I think you were in Madison when it happened. And it happened, it involved a former student here. And I was wondering if you can remember how it was dealt with by the campus. And that was the Lindbergh kidnapping. Do you remember anything about that?
Well, Charles Lindbergh lived right up here, in the next block.
On Regent Street?
Yes. No, I wasn't here then.
You weren't here then?
No.
Okay. How long did he live in Madison, didn't he?
Very briefly. Oh, matter of maybe a year.
But he lived right up on the...
Yes.
That's interesting. Sloan.
Nell Sloan. Politically, didn't belong in the Friday lunch group. She was a Republican. Her husband was an executive with Oscar Mayer.
Oh, yeah. How did she get involved?
Hazel Briggs, as she was then, wanted her in because Nell's son and Hazel's son were friends. She was never really one of us. She lived in Maple Bluff on Farwell Drive, way out on the lake.
How long was she a member?
Oh, she was a member until they left Madison, probably for about 10 years. And although it was always pleasant going out to her house, I thought her husband was a big windbag.
Did she ever feel, do you think she felt comfortable in the club?
No, and I don't think she enjoyed us.
Oh. But she came.
But she came. We never had coffee at her house. We always had Sanka. She didn't drink coffee.
Lived in Maple Bluff and you get Sanka.
Exactly.
Well, now we come to a very familiar name whom we've talked about this person before, and one of the real interesting people on campus, Louise Troxell.
Oh, Louise Troxell. Great friend of mine. Louise Troxell. Her husband died very early in her living, her tenure in Madison, Mark Troxell. She lived in the apartment flat above me when I lived on North Prospect Avenue. She was a widow for a while, and then Dr. Hugh P. Greeley, who had been divorced from his first wife and who had 5 children by his first wife, persuaded Louise to marry him. Hugh Greeley was a very well-known and prominent physician in Madison and had many friends and was very able. Everybody who was a friend of Louise Troxell urged her not to marry him. She had never had any children, and to inherit 5 difficult children was quite a task ahead of her.
What were the ages of the children?
Let's see, Roger was my daughter Jill's age, and he was probably about 14. Mm-hmm. He was the youngest. Anyway, she married Dr. Greeley. That marriage lasted probably about 8 years and ended in divorce. Louise's job as Dean of Women was very shaky at that time because people wondered whether the university would weather it, having her as Dean of Women and getting a divorce.
I mean, her job was shaky after she divorced,
yes,
really?
Yes. Well, when she announced, when people knew she was going to be divorced, there was a lot of consternation. She was Dean of Women. I'm not prepared to say whether I think she was a good dean or a bad dean. Maybe there isn't, maybe both of those adjectives wouldn't apply to her. She was politic.
What do you mean by that?
She wanted to be liked, and she stayed on the fence.
Okay.
She wasn't like Mrs. Rosenberry. I went to her retirement dinner at the University Club, and her speech was entitled 25 Years Without Sleep. Good title, but hardly accurate. I don't think myself that Louise was a great dean by any means, but she was a delightful person.
What about, was there any flack when she got married and she continued being dean and having all of a sudden 5 children to take care of?
Yes, there was a lot of talk. And her friends thought it was a very foolish thing for her to do. and she finally got tired of what she said to me one day. I'm tired of turning my salary over to Hugh's children. Well, what did she expect?
Was that the beginning of the end right there?
What did she expect? But Hugh Greeley was a very important person in this community. And then after his divorce from Louise, he married again a girl as young as his daughter.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
They're all dead now.
Mrs. Troxel Greeley, as I believe she was called on campus, or at least that's what they say in the Cardinal. They refer to her as Dean Troxel Greeley.
Do they?
Was it as when she got divorced, you said she had a little bit of trouble. Did men have trouble also with divorces, or was the fact that she was a woman?
No, it was the fact that she was Dean of Women.
Dean of Women.
In that position.
You're in charge of
They the felt discipline. It wasn't very yeah. good example to set.
Do you know if the university in any way, shape, or form put any pressure on her?
No, I don't know that.
Was it just generally friends talking?
I don't know.
Okay. Walton.
Dorothy Walton. Jim Walton was professor of chemistry. Next door neighbor of E.B. Rauschenbusch. Everybody liked Jim Walton. He died a great many years ago. Dorothy came from Michigan and was Dorothy Dana. And person of means, her father had the Dana Printing Company in Michigan. Dorothy came to this university and was one of a militant group of young women at that particular time who thought that sororities were undemocratic, and if they were already sorority members, a bunch of them resigned. And Dorothy Walton was one who did that. She has since, she's still living in New York City on Central Park West in one of those fabulously expensive apartment hotels with a police at the door and all, with one of her two daughters.
And her name is Dorothy Walton?
Her name is Dorothy Walton. Judy Walton lives in Madison here and is in extremely poor health with Parkinson's disease. Marcia, the other daughter, lives with her mother in New York.
Tell me a little bit more about the sorority girls, the sort of rebellion they had. What year was this approximately?
This was 1917 or 18.
Quite a while ago.
Yes.
I didn't realize it was that early. And they just decided that it was undemocratic.
Yes. They were one of these what do you call them? Women's liberation people. Okay. You know.
A little early. A little before their time.
Yes.
What?
Incidentally, we had some very talented women in this university at that time. Marjorie Canaan Rawlings, who wrote
The Yearling.
Yeah, The Yearling. Janet and Agnes Dury, D-U-R-I-E. Dorothy Walton. That whole group was the very, very up-and-coming people. My sister Helen belonged to that bunch.
Now, was there any reason why? Was it just kind of coincidence that it happened at this time, or was this sort of a national thing?
No, I think it was just, I don't think it was national, no.
So they were upset because the fraternity, well, how were the sororities undemocratic?
They thought the whole idea of fraternities and sororities was undemocratic.
Were they members?
But this didn't extend over to fraternities.
Oh, just the
sororities.
Were they in sororities themselves?
Yes.
Oh, so it was a rebellion.
So they resigned. It wasn't rebellion from any jealousy that they were not in or envy. They were in, but they got out.
Very interesting. Turn off there. That's very interesting about the sororities. I didn't realize there were any rebellions that early.
Did I have Mr. McGilvery down there? E.B. Evander Bradley McGilvery.
No, we didn't. No, you don't. You didn't tell me about it. McGilvery.
Professor McGilvery was professor of philosophy. He came here from California, Evander Bradley McGilvery. He was the son of a missionary and was born in Siam. Was translating somehow or other the Bible, but he ended up in Madison. They lived in the house on Arlington Place, which is now lived in by Hugh and Mildred Richards. Hugh Richards is either just retired or going to retire from the physics department. It's the house that Jennings built and was fired as state architect for stealing the stuff that the roof is now made of, that the roof is made of. But Professor McGilvery was a very strong person in the faculty. And they had a daughter, Margaret, and a son, Peyton. Margaret, when he came to teach philosophy, he rejected all of his religious training that he had as a youth. And they espoused the opposite. Their daughter Margaret, though, disappointed them very much by going with her uncle to Beirut, Syria, to do missionary work. Their son Peyton, P-A-T-O-N, whom they absolutely, absolutely idolized, met with a very unhappy and tragic end, became involved with some woman in Boston and was shot and killed. That rocked Madison completely. Mr. McGilvery stayed with us in Cambridge at the time that he came to Boston to investigate his son.
What year was his death? The death
it was in Boston.
Well, what year was that approximately?
19 or 20.
Okay. And did they ever catch the person who killed the son? Do you remember?
Mr. McGilvery told us when he was staying with us he was not going to press the case. Peyton was involved with some shady business with some man's wife, and he never pressed the charges. But you can imagine what that did to the family.
Yeah, I imagine how. Well, we have one name left on the list. Who always sat in the back row of the last seat of the last row in school all of her life? Her name is Wilson.
Well, I guess we don't need to go into very much about that.
Well, tell me about your relationship with the Friday Club.
It was very, very good, except that I didn't have their zeal for politics. And Rhoda Otto, when I say Rhoda, I mean Rhoda Otto's great condemnation with me, or of me, was, is she ever a lady? She used to say that about my mother, and that was not meant as a compliment from Rhoda. And anyway, I've enjoyed the Friday Lunch Group off and on. I'm not as dedicated to it as some of them are. But my interests were different. My interest was not politics. It was books. And they never quite liked the fact that I wasn't militantly a Democrat. But I wasn't. I never, it wasn't my great passion. And books were.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my great deprivation now, of course.
And that, of course, explains why you were such good friends with William Ellery Leonard, whose life was also...
Yes, you know, Ellery Leonard and I had such a wonderful friendship. And the only thing that's closest to it at all now, and of course he isn't here now, is Denny Fisher at UWM. And he's, of course, great many years younger than I. But Ellery was older than I. But it's, if you spent your life with books and suddenly are alive, but your great interest is not at your hand, it's not easy.
Yeah, I can imagine that.
So?
What Mrs. Wilson is saying for you listeners out there is she has some trouble reading books now.
Oh, can't read them at all.
And she uses magnifying glasses to a glass to.
Oh yes, my son-in-law has spent hundreds of dollars. But at least I played last Friday.
Yeah. Yes, you did. Did you win?
Well, we had one perfectly stupid hand. Do you know anything about
bridge? No, I don't. I'm not a bridge player.
So I won't go over it.
We have one other item on the agenda here, and then I think we're just about finished. And that is the Hill Folk.
The Hill Folk. Well, I'll show you the picture, but not today. It's upstairs. Okay. The Hill Folk was a club made up of, I won't say children, but teenage girls on University Heights. The members were Pauline, Mary, and Helen Buell. Martha, who was my friend, and I were not members because we were too young. So three of the four Buell girls, Catherine Maurer, Anna Ely, Margaret and Helen Knowlton, my two sisters, Helen Skinner, that's nine, Margaret McGilvery, Catherine Jackson, that's all I think. And Miss Charlotte Bodman was our chaperone, so to speak. And she was, at that time, Dr. Ely's secretary, Charlotte Bodman.
Now, what did the Hill...
They met probably every week. I have the whole book of their meetings in their own handwriting, which I'll show you. Would you like to see it?
Well, why don't we just talk about it for a few minutes here?
Yes. I don't know what, but see, I was never a member.
Oh, so you don't know exactly.
But I think they were devoted to good works.
Oh, okay. So they were young girls.
They were young girls and socially oriented.
Well, why don't we get that book and maybe I can read a few entries into the microphone here. I have the book here.
Yes,
the notebook.
Let me see the...
We can't identify the handwriting, but it's people in attendance are Margaret McGilvery, Margaret Knowlton, Leola Lorenz, and Catherine Jackson. They met at the house of Pauline and Mary Buell, B-U-E-L-L, Saturday evening, the 22nd of September, 1906, rather.
Yes.
At 6:45. I'm reading verbatim now. We organized a literary club today. A literary club with Catherine Jackson for secretary and decided to meet every Friday from 6:45 to 8 p.m. As we were reorganized into a social and reading club next day, I need not go into details of our planned studies. Enough to say is we began with Shakespeare's life. Next afternoon, Sunday the 23rd, we met at the house of Margaret McGilvery and reorganized our club, giving it the name of the Hill Folk. So there we have it. 23rd of September 1906 is when the name came up, which M.M. suggested, and taking rose and white for our colors. All the members were very glad to take the secretary's suggestion as to making ourselves a chapter of the St. Nicholas League, and the secretary was authorized to send for the league league badger ledger some badges I see. We drew lots for whom should choose a book to read, and Leola was the unfortunate one. The Little White Bird by Barry was suggested, but next day M.M. thought Unknown to History by Charlotte
Young,
I think.
Y-O-N-G-E.
Yeah. A good book for our purpose, and Leola decided to get it. The second meeting of the Hill Folk occurred Saturday, the 29th of September, 1906. We could not meet on the regular day because one of the members went to a party on that day. Well, that's a good reason for it. Yeah, I'm stopping for a second here. I'm just going to read this until the tape runs out, and then we'll end this interview. We gathered together at the house of Catherine Jackson, three of the members with sewing, and took turns reading aloud from The Crossing by Winston Churchill. We had finished three chapters by 10 minutes front of eight when we adjourned and wended our way home, and all vowing inwardly, I am sure, that we had a fine time.
Wended our way home.
Very dramatic stuff. The third meeting of the club was held October 5th, 1907, at the Knowltons' house, Mrs. Wilson's house. Two rules were made. First, that at the meetings of the Hill Folk or at informal meetings where a club question was being discussed, the president must keep the meeting orderly and make one member talk at a time. Second, that if the president was disobeyed in the preceding rule, a fine of 2 cents must be levied upon the disorderly person or persons. The club then proceeded to initiate three of the members, Margaret Knowlton, Catherine Jackson, and Margaret McGilvery, one at a time. We had an enjoyable and uproarious evening, and The Crossing was debated, I think.
Did you know those books, The Crisis, The Crossing, and Richard Carville?
Yeah.
Those three.
Friday, October 12, 1906, we met at the Lorenz's and had an enjoyable time eating delicious homemade candy, reading a chapter and a half of The Crossing, while one member sewed. We made one rule, namely that commencing with the November St. Nicholas, a contribution must be sent each month from the Hill Folk. Consequently, as long as the club consists of six, each member must send a contribution every 6 months. On October 19, 1906, the Hill Folk met at the home of Margaret McGilvery